sino que se hace de una manera eficaz, inteligente, y es, por ejemplo, enviando gente dentro del medio o buscando una manera de una censura solapada, pero no se puede hacer directamente porque sería atentar con la imagen de la democracia que tiene Estados Unidos.
Estos ataques pensantes de Washington son financiados, por supuesto, por los grupos de poder, y muchas veces es preferible seguir las ideas y las publicaciones que ellos hacen que los estudios que hacen los académicos, porque verdaderamente ahí es donde están las líneas que el gobierno y quienes están en el gobierno están interesados en promover. Últimamente hemos visto la publicación de toda una serie de ideas sobre el tema del rearme de los Estados Unidos, de la renovación de su arsenal nuclear, de las ventas de armamento al exterior, lo que va precisamente con la línea de la actual administración.
Ya en 1993 alguien escribió que el Consejo de Relaciones Exteriores corresponde a lo que uno podría llamar el establishment gobernante y que la membresía de los periodistas en él, aunque pueda pensar por sí mismos, es un reconocimiento a su papel activo e importante en los asuntos de este país. No solo analizan e interpretan la política exterior de Estados Unidos, sino que ayudan a hacerla. Ese alguien fue Richard Harwood, ex editor gerente y defensor del pueblo, precisamente del Washington Post. He aquí expuesta la delgada línea entre informar o servir de instrumento político en tiempos, además, de concentración mediática.
Aquí concluye esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Agradecemos la colaboración de RTN, de Telesur, del colectivo Más Voces, de Radio de Naciones Unidas, del Informativo Farco, de Hispan TV y del diario La Jornada. A nombre de Toshli y de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Hello, we're the Devil Makes Three. When we're not illegally downloading music from the internet, we're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.5 FM. Through every station in the house.
You fucked it up. Okay, let's try that again.
No way, that's the one.
And it's Thursday, the 29th of March, here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, and probably where you are too, or maybe not. We do archive these shows. I'm Robert Norris. This is Bathrobe Spears Broadsides coming up at you on 101.3 FM or freakradio.org. We're still looking for studio space, so in case you're looking for $500, give me a call, and I'll put you through to the collective. My number is 831-423-HUFF, or 423-4833. That's HUFF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. We meet every other week and brood and rant about how to stop the city's attack on homeless people. If you're interested in that, show up at the Sub Rosa Cafe next Wednesday, almost a week from now, and we will, you'll hear this and you'll hear that, and you'll be able to speak up, too, around the latest shenanigans from the shitty council and from other departments of the city that are actually more powerful than the city council. And we'll try to find some of our own power as well. So for the next 2 hours, we got some interesting stuff coming up. But again, as I said before, if you find, or maybe I didn't entirely say it before, but I've said it many times before, we're looking for a 10x10 space indoors or outdoors in the Santa Cruz area generally. It could be outside the city limits, but hopefully not too far outside. We've been considered Watsonville, but that's a ways away, where we can actually set up our equipment. There will be no question of legality or illegality, though we scorn at licenses. We believe free radio has to say what it fucking wants to say to emphasize the point. However, the building that we would be using for a studio space would be a place from which we go out by internet, and that is completely legal, no matter how cranky we sound or how many so-called obscenities. They aren't really obscenities, of course. The real obscenities are used daily and have to do with politicians and war and other things that are generally considered commonplace. So if you find us a 10x10 space with electricity, internet, and access to a bathroom or a toilet or a porta-potty, chamber pot, that's going a little far, we will, if we can hold this for a year, we will give you $500. So ignore the ringing you may hear in the background, and If you know of any such locations, do give a call or get in touch with us at freakradio.org, where you can also find schedules and, well, all kinds of information about Free Radio. In case you want to get more involved in Free Radio's activities, do your own antics on Free Radio. So featured today is going to be an interview with Santa Cruz City Councilman, woman, person, Sandy Brown, who, well, we talk about rent control, we talk about other items concerning homeless civil rights, and that, of course, is the main focus of this show, homeless civil rights. So that's the main focus, and we'll also be having an interview with a part of one with Salinas activist Wes White, who has been struggling to organize homeless people there, as well as to survive as a video journalist who isn't so much trying to make money, he doesn't make money that way, but to get information out to the community. And this is an interview that's been long delayed, but we're going to have that. Also, updates on the River Street campground from one of the employees, talking straight from the horse's mouth, so to speak. So don't go away, and we'll stay too.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap.
And it is indeed Free Radio Santa Cruz that you are tuned to at 101.3 FM and freakradio.org if you're on a computer, and perhaps you're listening to us on archives. Stay tuned now for the April 5th, 2018 show, the Thursday evening show of Bathrop Spears Broadside. We're going to be doing a lot of discussion and play around the upcoming rent control initiative, which is being circulated, the Just Eviction Protection Ordinance, and the current City Council's Emergency Ordinance, assuming they're ever going to enforce it, that passed in February. And other stuff, too, so don't go away.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't.
So let's begin with kind of a follow-up from last week. You may remember, regular listeners, that we did an interview with Councilwoman Sandy Brown, actually split over two shows, the Sunday show that goes from the morning to the afternoon and the evening show from a week ago. We talked to Sandy about rent control a lot, and she also gave us, I thought, pretty specific commitments to follow up on something that she has previously given very specific commitments to follow up on, but hasn't done, namely I've reduced it to four emails that I requested her to send to various city officials to document the fact that information is needed on a number of issues and that she wanted it, and we'd see if the city officials gave it. If they didn't give it, then they're on record as holding back. And that could be helpful in the future for individuals who are trying to document that there's a apparent failure on the part of the city staff to provide transparency and accountability, not just to the public, but even to the publicly elected officials. And often city elected officials who say they're going to help you on these issues will try to do so informally and verbally behind the scenes, which is fine if they can get the information. But the if that it doesn't seem to work, then it's really important for me that we get a clear history of city staff, because that's where the information comes from for the city officials and for the public, denying access. So what I requested from Sandy was the information from the city clerk, the acting city clerk, Bonnie Bush, about the claims against the city that we don't get to see, but that we are supposed to be able to comment on intelligently at city council meetings. That's, you know, where there's a lawsuit against the police department, let's say, for brutality. The request was that that be done to the city clerk, sent to the city clerk, and requested that information be provided regularly on the city council agenda. That was the first thing I requested. Second thing I requested was something from the police department, that there seems to be a discrepancy between how musicians, vendors, and just ordinary people sitting downtown on the sidewalk or against a building in those rare legal spots where you're allowed to sit, can do so without being molested by the roaming parks and rec patrols or by the Santa Cruz Police Department if they have what's called a display device. That is a little table or a cap in front of them if they're soliciting funds or trying to get, I don't know, some kind of donation for their music or something that political literature on it, perhaps. The A-frame signs that the large commercial businesses have, while completely illegal, according to what I've been repeatedly told by city officials over the last 2 or 3 years, are nonetheless ignored and tolerated by the police and by the city. But homeless-looking folks or people of color or young people or just people the police decide they want to move along or someone the merchants don't like out there for some reason or want to complain about, are told they have to move every hour, or maybe even they have to move even if it isn't an hour. So I wanted to get information from the police department on actual citations issued to businesses for their illegal signs. And that hasn't been forthcoming, so that was what was also requested of Sandy Brown. Also requested from the police department the correspondence around the famous ICE raids of a year ago, the ICE agent that was sort of supposedly, we suddenly found out from retiring Chief Vogel, or retreating Chief Vogel, now, of course, it's Chief Mills, ensconced in the police department for a decade. That is, say, the Immigration Services apparently had their snitch sitting there in the police department in violation of the city's policy of not colluding, and this break up the family's nativist bigoted attack on immigrants. And also the Sean Arlt shooting a year and a half ago, where Sean Arlt was shot dead by police officers, one police officer, and we didn't get the reports from the police department of what actually went down. We got a cover story, we got a little bit of video, but we didn't get the actual full investigative reports, and I asked that these be demanded of the police department by a city council member, and I think that's an important thing to do, particularly the city council member claims to have an interest and says they're going to do it, and then doesn't do it. And then finally, I requested of Parks and Rec Department, apparently retiring Chief Mauro Garcia, why it is their citations just are not mentioning the race of the person that they're giving a ticket that they have to show up in court for or face hundreds of dollars in fines for such things as being in a park after dark, having a dog off a leash, smoking a cigarette in a park even though no one is disturbed by it, sleeping and camping, although there were very few, and like only 2 camping tickets for the month of February. This was simply, again, a request of the Parks and Rec Department to provide these stats. They don't give you the stats. They will make available, after a delay, the individual citations. So you can go through them one by one and find out. But they should be, of course, providing a matrix. And they did this to some extent for the city council. But there were missing items from it, and I requested that, and Sandy agreed to get this, and she hasn't done it. So I'm just mentioning this for the community to know that I'm having trouble getting information from a city council member who, in some respects, may be one of the better city council members that we have there, but is apparently unable or unwilling to keep her word on this particular issue. And right before this broadcast, I left her a phone message suggesting, you know, am I missing something? Is there a death in the family? Are you ill? Are you being held hostage in a broom closet somewhere? You know, so, you know, is there some reason that this hasn't happened? But I haven't heard anything, and she hasn't picked up her calls. You should know that if you want to get in touch with Sandy Brown, you can give her a call, and she has a cell phone number which she gives out, and it can sometimes be reached on. 246-0399 is her number, 246-0399. Also, she has regular meeting times. I think it is, let me double check here. It's 2 to 4 p.m. on Mondays, and she appreciates a call first, she says, so that she can plan her time and make sure it doesn't bump into other meetings. So, Sandy's a person that I'm going to be, we've been kind of negotiating with to get some kind of statement. Well, some members of the organization I work with, HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, want there to be a David Silva Day. This is a little sort of a memorial thing that the city council does, usually with police officers and other mucky mucks, and occasionally does it with ordinary people who have died or even who are still alive, as a sort of a tribute to what they've done. And this was done with homeless activist Linda Edwards years ago. I don't know if anybody remembers her who's listening to this broadcast now. Some may. I called her Linda the Lark. She was active and fearless, actually, or willing to deal with master and overcomer fears in confronting police violence and confronting abuses against the homeless and standing up to city council and other lying and hypocritical social service agencies that were claiming to be helpful but actually were holding down their warming their chairs, so to speak. She died in 1995 of cancer, and she was, after some lobbying by Catherine Byers and the subsequent mayor, Mike Rotkin, given a day. That is to say, they made an announcement that she was, this would be Linda Edwards Day. You can see this on city council agendas when they have, usually there's three or four different people who are honored with a particular day. So anyway, some people in HUF want to do this for activist David Silva, who regular listeners know, may remember, died in Maputo, Mozambique about a month ago now, or several weeks anyway, of pneumonia, or certainly kind of unclear what he died of. And there'll be a memorial coming up for David that HUF and other agencies and organizations are sponsoring. But I was never a big fan, really, of going to city council and trying to get a day for David, because I think in a way it's kind of, what would you say, counterproductive or hypocritical, or it's like trying to get a badge of honor from the military or something. You know, you don't, it's not something I think you might want it, though. I mean, other people in HUF thought that too. So I guess some HUF members are going to continue to lobby Sandy Brown and Chris Crone and maybe some other of the council members who remember seeing David Silva sitting in the front row of city council meetings and sort of tottering over to the podium. I would totter afterward. And asking that the sleeping ban be ended, demanding that the sleeping ban be ended, and noting that he was doing a fast against the sleeping ban, and others in the community were too, a peculiar kind of fast where a person would try to stay awake all night to follow the sleeping ban law, which is no sleeping or covering up with blankets outside in a vehicle or in any structure, not a house or a hotel, after 11 o'clock at night, which sounds pretty ridiculous to an ordinary citizen, but has been the Santa Cruz law since 1978. And has been enforced whenever the police want to. And, of course, it hasn't been enforced vigorously in the sense of in every case, or there would be no room. Everybody would be stacked like cordwood in the jails. So, in any case, other people will hopefully be carrying forth that day. There'll be a memorial for David Silva, probably coming up on a Saturday in the next month, in May. It's going to be, I think, as I understand it, hopefully managed by his niece, who will be coming to town to work on it. If anybody wants more information about it, they can give me a call at 423-HUFF, 423-HUFF, 423-4833. If you call during the show, you may get me, you may get an answering machine, but this is, of course, a pre-recorded show. We are still studioless, and I guess it's time for me to remind everybody, $500 waiting for you if you can find us at 10x10 space. And it doesn't even have to be in Santa Cruz. We're actually now expanding our outreach, looking for something in the surrounding area, Felton, Live Oak, Scotts Valley, San Lorenzo Valley. It might be a little far. A place where we can rent for a year. If you find us a place we can rent for a year, has access to electricity, bathroom facilities, internet, you get $500. So give a call to the same number if you have any clues or hints on that one, 423-4833. Or if you're interested in becoming a member of the collective, we still do broadcast without a studio, as you can hear. And Free Radio Santa Cruz is on the air 24 hours a day. Sometimes it feels like 48 hours a day. In spite of the fact that we have no studio. We work it through a kind of distant broadcasting. But we would do much better with the studio, as I've said many a time. And we'll hopefully not have to say many a time again. But it's an opportunity for folks out there. We found a studio once before. We kicked down $500 before. And we'll do it again because we need a studio. And I think, frankly, the community benefits from us. So if you want to be involved in Free Radio, give me a call too, and I'll kind of hook you up as to where to go. You can also go to the Free Radio Santa Cruz website, freakradio.org, and you'll get more information there, including schedules of what's coming up in the air and some archives of some folks' shows and so forth. My show is archived extensively on another website, huffsantacruz.org, and it's a pretty cluttered but action-packed, or I should say information-packed website. Some of it outdated, but some of it very current. So check it out, huffsantacruz.org, if you're interested. I'd hope to contact Joyful Heart, an employee out at the Homeless Lack of Services Center, the River Street Campground. Sometimes all these social service providers look alike. But I got to say, there is a significant difference with the homeless between the Homeless Lack of Services Center at 115 Coral Street, which includes the Pauley Loft and the Rebelli Family Shelter, River Street Shelter, and stuff like that. I guess there's also the Page Smith Community House. And the River Street Campground, which is different in the sense that River Street actually allows you to stay during the day. It allows you to leave your stuff there during the day. It allows you to... you can't come and go because there's this weird paranoid contract made. You have to sign when you go in that says you can't walk in and you can't walk out. If you do, you'll be either punished or expelled or in some way sanctioned. It's against the rules. But there is shuttle service, and it does provide you with a private space, unlike almost all previous shelter options that weren't campgrounds, and there weren't really any government-funded campgrounds until this one, a point that Huff activist Bob LaMonica brought up at the last Huff meeting, which we had yesterday. If you want to come to a Huff meeting, it's every other Wednesday, and you get free coffee. And lots of back-and-forth discussion and controversy. Anyway, I had hoped to have some more details on the campground. I interviewed Joyful Heart before, but unfortunately he's not reachable at this time, or he's not answering his phone. I was directed to something that will enable folks to maybe get a peek inside the River Street Campground. It is a dinner service sign-up list, which you can find online. It's under signupgenius.com. And it's you can actually sign up for slots to do dinner, which is between 4:30 and 6. Otherwise, you're not allowed into the campground. That's another one of the peculiar requirements that's different than the previous San Lorenzo campground, which was in the San Lorenzo Benchlands, San Lorenzo Park area, where you could actually go in and out when you pleased, and you also you could have visitors come visit you. Now, no visitors allowed. I don't know exactly if they are interfering with communications between the outside and people inside the tents. That was alleged by Sandy Brown, I believe, at a city council meeting, but then there was some hurried reassurance given. I think it wasn't by Susan O'Hara, who is the city manager's go-to woman for the campground. Under her is the guy who's actually running it, but he doesn't live there, Chris Monteith, and under him are the people who are with the downtown safety team, I think they're called. They are wearing orange jackets. They are allowed to walk up and down Highway 9. They are allowed to walk to and from the camp, unlike other less privileged members of what I call at times the Boneyard Barbed Wire Campground, because it was previously called the Boneyard, where it stored, I guess, some city water equipment or some such thing. And it also has barbed wire all around it, and a little razor wire, too, off to the side, which I was going to ask how the residents of the campground regard that. I guess it may not be as important as whether, you know, you are treated obviously it's not as important as whether you're treated properly inside. And I don't have a lot of information about that at the moment. Hopefully I'll be getting more. Joyful Heart, the employee who I interviewed last week, did say that he was trying to get me a visitor's pass, but I haven't heard back. Apparently, the city manager, Susan O'Hara, had heard the previous broadcast and wasn't terribly pleased with our interview, because I'm a critic of this campground, although I have some praise for it, too. It's a mixed kind of response I have to it, but I have been particularly critical of Susan O'Hara for her collusion with the city in creating anti-homeless laws and helping to raise anti-homeless hysteria and what I would call fake news, to use a phrase that's used a lot these days by different folks. That is to say that homeless people are somehow a big crime problem, that there's a big public safety issue around homelessness for middle-class people who have to cower in their homes unless there are new, worse laws that prohibit people, for example, from holding signs up on medians or make it illegal for them to be in a park after dark. And if they are, we won't even wait for the courts. We'll ban them by the police department's edicts if they just find them, and we'll subject them to a year in jail if they violate the ban, even though they've never been found guilty of even a crime in the park, except perhaps being there after dark or some such thing. And Susan O'Hara was involved in all that stuff, plus programs that purport to assist the so-called worst homeless offenders downtown, the repeat offenders who are arrested for nuisance crimes. Crimes is used, of course. That's their terminology, not mine. She falsely told me some years ago, I think it was pretty much not the truth, that the PACT program, it was called something else, DAP, I believe, Downtown Assistance Project, perhaps, not sure, which, you know, had the DA getting together with the probation authorities, getting together with the police, getting together with the judges to find some solutions for these homeless people who, you know, just can't seem to stop getting being found with an open container downtown, or something to that effect. No, she insisted that this was not being done under the sleeping ban or the sitting ban or the other essentially get them out of sight, out of town ordinances that have nothing to do with real crime and everything to do with the aesthetical, cruel aesthetic demands of paranoid and essentially bigoted people. Bigoted certainly in this regard. You know, I know a lot of people who I like as human beings, but they're bigoted on these issues, or they're frightened on these issues. And folks in power cater to them. Just as in the 20s, there was massive catering to the Ku Klux Klan, just as today racism permeates American society and the police departments, and we continue to have police officers gunning down blacks and whites, too, for that matter, and special privileges and powers that we can't control because of, it's actually, in the case of the police, it's a matter of not just bigotry, it's a matter of sort of false privilege and power that is not under public control and not under community control. Anyway, you can sign up for to serve dinner at the River Street Campground if you want. I think you can apply for a visitor's pass. There's also ways to get signed up for the waiting lists, which it's still not clear to me why there is a waiting list, or how do I put it? I think there are about 50 tents in the camp, and they're all very, very close to each other. And it looks a little to me like crowding rats into a cage, but there is a certain element of privacy, an element of property security. I haven't heard of any accounts yet of people's property being stolen. One woman called me today, actually, to ask if the security situation for homeless folks there was better than at the Association of Faith Communities Winter Shelter, whose program is ending completely. I believe it's already ended in, it's either out, one of the two winter shelter programs has ended at the end of March, and another one is ending in April 14th or some such. I may be playing an interview with this woman who wishes to remain anonymous, though sharp-eared listeners may recognize her. She's been on the air before. She wants to know about security out there at the River Street Campground, which will be going until June 30th. And I haven't heard bad reports about that. That's another thing I'll be asking Joyful Heart about if I ever get a hold of him again. But the question for me, that began this lengthy blah 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 that I've been giving you, is if you have 50 tents and you have you allow two people in a tent, because that's what they say they were doing at least in some of the tents, why not let more people in if there's a long waiting list? And you know, maybe that they require people who are already in the tents to okay a second person. It may be that special privileges are given to those who are on the downtown safety team, who are essentially the internal policing group for the camp, and a lot of them are homeless, and so that's has both its good side and its bad side, as I've discussed in previous shows. And so I'm looking for more information from it. Don't have any right now to give you, but I can give you a musical break, and I'll do that right now.
Farewell, you northern hills, you mountains, all goodbye. Moorland and stony ridges, crags and peaks, goodbye. Gledafach, farewell. Coldbank, Scawfell, cloud-bearing Suvan. Sun-warmed rock and the cold of Bleaklow's frozen sea.
the snow and the wind and the rain of hills and mountains. Days in the sun and the tempered wind and the air like wine. And you drink and you drink till you're drunk on the joy of living. Comes. You filled all my days, held the night at bay, dearest companion. Years pass by and are gone with the speed of birds in flight. Our life like the verse of a song heard in the mountains. Give me a hand and love and join your voice with mine. We'll sing of the hurt and the pain and the joy of living. Farewell to you, my chicks. Soon you must fly alone. Flesh of my flesh, my future life, bone of my bone. May your wings be strong, may your days be long, safe be your journey. Each of you bears inside of you the gift of love. May it bring you light and warmth and the pleasure of giving. Eagerly savor each new day and the taste of its mouth. Never lose sight of the thrill and the joy of living. Take me to some high place of heather, rock and lane. Scatter my dust and ashes, feed me to the wind, so that I will be part of all you see, the air you are breathing. I'll be part of the curlew's cry and the soaring hawk, the blue milkwort and the sundew hung with diamonds. I'll be riding the gentle wind that blows through your hair, reminding you how we shared in the joy of living.
And that was Peggy Seeger and Ewan McCall, two of my favorite old-time singers. Peggy's still alive, Ewan's gone. Singing from their album Items of News, The Joy of Living. It's a little slow, a little sad, but, you know, I liked it. And usually they've got some pretty brisk political songs that I play, and I'll probably be playing some of those pretty soon. It's also old. This is from the 80s. And it's online, though, in case you ever want to check it out there. I actually first heard it through a vinyl disc, a record, as we used to call them, that I had to get from England. Wow. So a week ago, there was a rally in front of Santa Cruz City Hall, right between the two council sessions. There was an afternoon council session and an evening council session. I'm not sure if I'm going to play any of the oral communications from the 5 o'clock sort of doghouse oral communication session because it's, well, we'll see. But I did go outside after that was over and sort of lingered with this mass of people that was gathering. Part of it had to do with a rally for rent control and just eviction legislation that had already been passed by the city council a month before, but now the advocates are trying to get initiatives on the ballot. They have to do this by September with thousands and thousands of signatures from the city residents, city voters, in order to strengthen and maintain the law after November, actually after September. They got to get the signatures by September to get it on the ballot, and then if they can do that, the current emergency ordinance, which freezes rents and provides some, requires landlords not to those. I think it's, and that's a question I really should have been asking, and maybe I'll be able to find it out in the course of this broadcast. I'm not, rent freeze only applies to 22% of the rental units in Santa Cruz because of the nasty real estate mogul state law that was passed in the 90s, the Costa-Hawkins law that essentially guts rent control and is some people are trying to change at the state level. But it does affect 22% of the rentals, this rent freeze. They can only raise rents by 2% unless there's some special problem a landlord has or requires putting more money into the property that's really a legitimate and not a I want to make more money kind of thing. But the protection from evictions means that they can't. They have to keep renting to you if you're willing to pay rent and if you haven't been engaged in criminal activity, or they can't just sort of cook up a pretext to kick you out because they want to put somebody else in. And often this is a pretext to raise the rent, as you'll hear activist Cynthia Berger with one of the rental, the tenant organizations, later talk about on this show. In any case, there was also a mass of people gathering around the issue of affordable housing. You know, should there be diminished requirements for legalizing ADUs, accessory dwelling units? What about requirements that there are low-income housing or that affordable housing be built, where affordable is kind of a yuck-yuck phrase that is, what we really have is profiteering housing being built and very little rental housing going up. And there was a whole bunch of people who were hostile to the rent control folks. But it was a mixed bag out front because, well, a lot of people were gathering. It was interesting, and I'm going to play some of that audio now.
It's March 27th. About 6:30 at the Santa Cruz for Housing Justice rally in front of City Hall. Got about 10 people here.
Okay. It's really wrong. And it's also proven if you look through all the other communities in which rent control has happened, there's been a huge loss of housing. And the housing that's left gets very expensive.
There's 17 houses on the market right now.
Yeah, oh, there's going to be a lot
17,
more.
17.
It ends up harming those who...
And as you're hearing, this is an opponent of rent control, claims that rental housing, rent control removes rental housing from the market.
It was intended to help. And I'm not a landlord, but it's just, I know people from rent-controlled areas, it's a really horrible thing.
It costs a hockey stick.
And it also, I mean, well, then you're also...
We have some landlords here who are, or should I say pro-landlord folks, who are arguing the case against rent control.
Actually, the ordinance specifically provides that if a landlord is going to move back into a house where a tenant is living in the ground, the landlord can displace the tenant.
Six months.
And say you were giving them under market rent, and now you've got to, get them...
What's that
market
all about?
How that's crazy. Do that?
Well, that's, I mean, say you're a tenant.
You're feeling upset that your property rights are being restricted.
Good, I'm glad.
I understand that. And here's the thing. At the moment, I basically don't. I'm confused. We just sat here and listened to your opinion. I'm a little confused. We just listened to you, so it would be nice if you listened to you for 5 minutes.
I've got friends that are renters, and they are one renter.
This is
we get it. It's tough here. It's tough. It's tough for renters. It's tough for owners. We get it. This is just not the right. This is too much.
Do you want to hear what they have to say?
Because I do.
I do.
I'm sorry.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Oh, the other two people that want.
Oh, yeah, they left.
Wanted to re-engage. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
You know what I'm hearing these people say is that there might be people that put a lot of savings and spend a lot of time into getting the savings together to own a
rental
property.
This is a rent control advocate.
And that, you know, sometimes those people might be, you know, okay.
Not get as much profit as
not get as much profit as they want to from that rental property, and that it's very upsetting. I thought he wanted to hear what I had to say.
I do.
Oh, well.
I'm listening.
Okay. All right. Well.
Trying to help you along.
Sorry.
Everyone else is listening, too.
Okay. I guess, you know, we're arguing for people to have rights and not just property to have rights. I do think that, you know, you can make an argument that you deserve to be able to have some fair return on your investment. And I'm not here to stop that from happening, but I'm here to say that I have rights, too, as a human being. I have right to live somewhere.
I'm the devil's advocate. I'll say, wait a minute, you're cutting back the whole... There'll be no housing built. What's going on here?
That's a speculative argument, right? Mountain View, which just passed a rent control measure in 2016, has actually had a boom in new housing development. Interestingly enough, one of the main people who sponsored the anti-campaign is the company that's actually doing a lot of the development.
That's so kind of strange, isn't it?
That's very interesting to me. It almost makes me think that these arguments are not really made by people who actually care about the supply of affordable housing.
Have to think about that one. The subcommittee that is again coming up with a final report now, or a revised report?
My understanding is tonight they're asking for an extension so that they can continue studying it, and then they'll report out in August, I believe, is what their request is going to be. But I'm not 100%
sure. And the substance of what they're looking at is what? I'm not quite sure. They've already favored this. What else are they looking for?
Yeah, I would encourage you to read the charter for the housing subcommittee, and it's pretty revealing. I can't explain.
You've done the housing element, right, that study? Because this is the housing element in the city.
No, that's different. Yeah.
And what we're talking about here outside, still outside the council in the minutes before the 7 p.m. session, is this housing element discussion that's coming up. There's been sort of endless, looked to me like pretty endless, discussions of housing for the last year under Mayor Cynthia Chase, and continuing now under Mayor David Terrazas. And Sandra Brown, council member who I interviewed last week, seemed to be kind of in agreement that this was more of the same discussion without much action. And that, of course, concerned the audience. Mostly the audience was looking, I think, to protect their properties rather than find more space and better rental conditions for renters, except in the most sort of... Well, only if that also involved protection of existing rental arrangements by those who have been raising rents progressively or regressively over the last couple of decades.
And that's not being discussed tonight, or that is?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, we're all ignorant here, I guess.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hi. Good to see you again.
So this is a collection of folks, some of whom are opponents of rent control and just eviction protections. And again, it's not clear how this is coming up on the agenda, if it is. Anything you folks would like to say for free radio? Any thoughts on this?
I don't have no thoughts.
Oh, well, you don't seem like a thoughtless person.
No, I'm sorry. I don't really have any thoughts for the radio.
Yeah, okay. Well, we'll leave it at that, right? It says, what are your fears should the other side win? Uh-huh. And which side are you representing? I'm with Free Radio.
At the moment, I'm representing the side of trying to have compassionate conversations between differences.
So you're not taking one side per se around rent control, or you want to see a dialogue.
Yeah. See people we get better at empathizing with each other and understanding our different perspectives.
You're an optimist here. I can see that.
Well, I'm a pragmatist. There are really good ways that people can learn to be more curious about each other and more compassionate.
And I'm sure that's true. I don't know if this issue, which hits the pocketbook so hard, is one that, is going to be that road that way, but I hope you're right.
It's a long-term project.
Or short-term, unless you not enough money to pay your rent, right?
For that purpose, but in terms of the longer-term goals about being able to listen to each other across differences and be compassionate towards the other on both sides, that's a big project. Human beings, we're in the beginning of evolution still.
I see. You want to say who you are for Free Radio?
Sure, I'm Andrew Perchin.
Thank you, Andrew.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Groups have sort of separated. There's a rental justice group, or Santa Cruzans for Rent, for housing justice, which has about 10 people here. And then the landlord, hey, Steve Plaich. You're in blue, I noticed. So we're going to do a quick interview with you now that you've come up. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Yeah. So Steve Plaich, you're running for not for the shitty council anymore, but for the even shittier Board of Stupid Vipers.
Before we listen to Steve's campaign pitch for Board of Supervisors that he's running for, again, a reminder to new listeners, Steve Plaich is a perennial city council candidate who has also been warming the chair of a number of boards, the ACLU, I call it the Anti-Racism Coalition, or the We Talk Like We're Anti-Racist But Don't Hold Deputies or Police Accountable for Anything They Do Coalition, because that's how I've seen them. He's also on the board of MH Can. He's gotten a lot of flack from me in the last couple of shows most particularly for his position as the really the sole activist on and the founder of and the creator of and the guy who runs the Homeless Persons Legal Assistance Project, because he has a law degree or he's passed the bar, or I'm never quite clear exactly what his status is. I think he's clarified it several times, but he takes an interest in the legalistic side of things in court, but he also seems to be very concerned with getting on boards of directors and amassing those. He believes, I guess, that the way to power is through the system of hierarchical steps that you take in a way that actually is above and beyond the real day-to-day life of the community, but has power over the community because of the consent the community gives to these so-called representative institutions. And that's sort of standard stuff. You learn it in elementary school, in high school, in college, that's the way the American system runs. Well, or doesn't run, as the case may be, which I think we are continuing to increasingly find out. Anyway, I'd be concerned about the Homeless Persons Legal Assistance Project not giving the kind of stats and assistance that homeless people, at least the group that I've been with, HUF, has requested. One of the main problems homeless people are having is this tendency of the courts to use a constitutionally suspect provision. Must be a provision of the law. I've asked Steve Plaich to get more specifics about it, and I haven't been able to get much from him. The so-called failure to pay additions to charges. So what happens is you get a ticket, let's say a ticket for sitting next to a building downtown, which is a crime, even if you're not blocking the sidewalk, even if the building is closed, even if the building is vacant, even if nobody's trying to get past, it can be the basis for a $200 or $300 citation. Then if you don't show up in court, perhaps you're unable to show up in court, or you're getting harassment citations from the police for that and sleeping and being in a park. If you're a homeless person, in other words, who the police prefer to encourage you to get out of town or get out of sight, then you can get a $200 or $300. The ticket is it shows up in court, you're not there. Instead of there being a warrant being issued to demand you appear to answer the charges, which has been the case, it was the case until about 2005 or 2006, maybe a little later, here in Santa Cruz. But they found that, of course, rounding up people for sleeping tickets, who then would go out and sleep again because they didn't have any other choices, was really not a judicious use of police deputy and court time. So they cooked up this new system, which they simply fine you in absentia without a trial, or the trial doesn't exist because you're not there, and then they send it south for collection. And then if you don't pay that, it goes onto your record. You can be denied a driver's license. Your wages can be, if you get a job later, can be impounded. There are other credit implications. And it's pretty nasty stuff, particularly since it's done without your presence there and without a court, without a really a court hearing. I mean, the court gives you the hearing in the sense that it notices that you're not there and then just finds you guilty because you're not there and you've failed to pay. So I've asked Plaich to look into this issue because many, many homeless people are getting this failure to pay consequence, which is injurious to their in all kinds of ways, as I've mentioned before. There's also a city law that says if you are if you get three infraction tickets that you don't pay, infractions are the minor the most minor ticket, that supposedly don't involve jail, but then in order to make sure that you tremble before the police and do what they say, that's really what the whole issue is here, to get you to obey authority regardless of the economic consequences, the irrationality, the discriminatory aspect of it, the economic inequality, whatever, that doesn't matter. You must obey authority because it's the law. So anyway, I've asked Plaich to look into failure to pay, and he's given me... He's essentially declined to do it, but he's done so with a lot of rhetoric, which hasn't been helpful. And at the Huff meetings, we were still trying to figure out ways to, you know, to get some more assistance. Obviously, we should stop beating on poor Steve Plaich, who's, you know, acquiring boards of director chairs and just not and doing other things for homeless people. And so he does charity drives in the sense that he organizes was involved in the organizing of the meals, the Thanksgiving meal and sometimes a Christmas meal, and he's at the Red Church every Monday giving out bagels, or often there anyway. And it's just perhaps this is a necessary part of the necessary is perhaps a bad way to put it, a bad but inevitable part of being on the board of directors. You suddenly become much more secretive, you become much more collusive with authorities that are actually the problem rather than the solution, and you aren't accessible to the public. And you don't want to answer real troubling questions that get to the heart of things, because it exposes the ineptness, the insufficiency, the futility of your position, except as some kind of a merit badge on your chest that you can use to climb to higher office with or get more power with, and perhaps in the hope, in the legitimate hope, that someday you can make the changes you need to make. I've often been a believer, I mean, I've pretty much consistently been a believer that trying to go through boards of directors, representative government, while it's something that can be successful if you have sufficient money and power, is not usually open to really low-income and poor people, that they need to raise a stink at a level that essentially shakes the foundations, or they don't get heard at all. And that is something that Steve has done that too. Steve Plaich has done that too, but only when there were masses of people doing it. At the, for example, I don't know, generally speaking, when there's mass appeal, during the Occupy movement, for instance. Steve shows up with a placard about the as a peace activist at the town clock, for instance. At least he used to regularly. So you know he tries to be involved in a lot of these things. In any case, you're going to hear him discussing issues that, frankly, I wish I'd cut him off on. But let's hear, because frankly, he's running as in the Board of Supervisors race. It's coming up. I think it's in May or June. The election is against a really much worse person, Ryan Coonerty, who's part of the Coonerty family, which owns the bookshop Santa Cruz, but has also been traditionally hostile to homeless folks in terms of creating anti-homeless laws to supposedly benefit merchants downtown, but actually sterilize, homogenize, gentrify the scene on Pacific Avenue and in other business districts and in the city generally. Let's hear some more. Steve Plaich.
Why is that?
Well, you know, honestly, I think the whatever career arc there is, my political life kind of moved beyond city council. I don't sometimes think that they have enough influence or enough or persuasive enough in ways that I would like to see them be, particularly with mental behavioral health. You know that I'm the chairman of the board of directors for MHCAN, so we want to see as much of an increase in access to behavioral health services and support as we can. And that's just not a function of city council, never has been.
And, of course, his MHCAN situation is notorious. He and his board of directors have surrendered a lot of the powers of MHCAN, allowed an intrusive police guard. Actually, I guess MHCAN folks are not terribly concerned about their security guard, but he surrendered the MHCAN's need to have a more extensive hours, need to have more than 50 people a day being allowed in there, need to be freed from the stigma that was being created by the police department and some of the neighbors suggesting that people with mental disabilities or homeless people should not be allowed to loiter or linger in the area because it was something they don't like and it doesn't look good. Food distribution was cut off thanks to a deal that Plaich and his board of directors made. I talked about the MHCAN sellout at some length last fall, and it's an example of how good people put into hierarchical systems turn bad because they have to collude with that system in order to retain their credibility or whatever.
So as a board, as a supervisor, I can really increase those programs and
plus
get them.
The salaries are higher as well for
supervisors. Well, yeah, significantly.
Considerably higher.
Significant, yeah, significantly. But as you know,
What have the supervisors done or not done around the issues of? Well, let me ask you about Laura's Law. Now, Laura's Law, as you know, is this lock them up more easily for their own good and needles on wheels if they don't pay attention. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I don't believe the Board of Supervisors ever passed a resolution in favor of...
It has, certainly.
It has now?
Has not, but, I'm, not. But other counties have.
No.
Laura's Law, of course, is a law that makes it easier to commit people for psychiatric observation and also to forcibly medicate them. It's been passed in a number of counties in California and many states, and I continue to worry that it's going to be passed here, although I get reassurances, which I'm not entirely satisfied with, from those who are keeping an eye on it. Plaich on the board of MHCAN, you would think, would be a person particularly well-suited to know what's going on, and he doesn't, really. But... maybe there's nothing to know. Maybe there's no threat. Maybe I'm just shouting wolf to the hills.
Of course, no. MHCAN has taken a strong position against that. You know, we just don't believe that that's the right approach. So, you know, that's really all there is to say about that. And we've made very public statements about that.
Are the drones coming?
The drones are that. That's actually my plane.
So you're out of here.
For third district supervisor Banner. If you look up, you squint really hard.
I can see the moon up there. Yeah. I've often taken you to task, Stephen, particularly recently, for not yet providing us with a sort of a detailed sense of the kind of work you've done for homeless folks, and that's my stomping ground or my squishing ground or something. In the last year, what would you say has happened for you and homeless folks in terms of stuff you've tried to do and been successful, stuff you tried to do and been unsuccessful? And I'm trying to leaving out the obvious, like the freedom sleepers or...
Oh, well,
you know.
I think, as you know, I think it's probably been a year ago, maybe now, that they came back with the Homeless Coordinating Committee's report. You were here for that, and I was here for that, and a lot of us testified that one of their long-range strategic plans was a year-round shelter. And we said, no, we need year-round shelter now. And so now they have the River Street camp, and when that River Street camp ends in late June, there's plans for another camp somewhere else. And then after
tent,
that,
maybe.
And then after that, then other camps, there's a phase two and phase three. So I think we'd be able to push the city council to get closer to year-round shelter. That's,
of course, the problem with this whole line of, well, this talking point, if you will, is that the shelter situation only affects a minority, even a small minority, of homeless people. And what is really of concern is how the majority is being treated. And Steve originally was very involved in the Freedom Sleepers, which did a Tuesday night sleep out, for those who don't remember or are new to this, in front of City Hall, demanding, because of the shutdown in homeless services in the summer of 2015, when they weren't really serving the majority of homeless people anyway, or even a significant minority, but people were getting harassed by police, ticketed, and so forth, and still are, although they don't do it under the sleeping ban anymore so much. And it was, the far focus was on the sleeping ban, with the Freedom Sleepers in front of City Hall. And Steve would come... spend a period of time there, as would I, but it instead of protests in other cities, actually involved a continuous presence, and that didn't happen. The people that started the Freedom Sleepers only came every week. Now, it became a certain sort of a beacon of light in a way, sort of a symbolic and persistent presence, and indeed it upset authorities, so that City Manager Martin Bernal put in Klieg lights and noisy machines, noisy, stinky machines that were generators that were providing power for the Klieg lights. And he also pushed through ordinance enforcement that had people being harassed at that one night, closed the bathrooms, and eventually drove away the Freedom Sleepers in the late spring and early summer of last year, 2017. So, but the whole point of having talking about shelter, the city council's shelter initiatives, as though they were something of substance, is it really, I think, does a disservice to the community. It's not real shelter. It's a talking point for Steve to, you know, add to his credit sheet, you know, but it's not there. It doesn't really address the real issues, which is the safety of people who currently sleep outside all over the city. That's the majority of people who are homeless. That's the majority of people that we have to be concerned with, not the few who get into the River Street campground, or even the few who are tolerated in the larger San Lorenzo campground, relative few. Less than 100 people, 120 people there. And in the winter shelter program, at a similarly small number. We're talking from 1,000 to 2,000 homeless people in Santa Cruz. And the issue has to be the decriminalization of the homeless, which Steve has spoken out on. But The real issue is, what is he and his ACLU board, and he's the vice chair of the ACLU board, done on that issue? Now, certainly he hasn't pushed legislation like Ryan Coonerty, his opponent in the Board of Supervisors race, to make it illegal to socialize by your car in a city parking lot. That is one of the government parking lots where, you know, you either pay to park or you can park free, but which now make it illegal to be there unless you're parking and retrieving your vehicle or walking right through. And which are now being, more tickets are being given out for that, I noticed, when I was looking over Parks and Rec citations for the month of February about a week ago. Let's hear more from me and Uncle Steve.
Something that I think has been a valuable effort on everybody's part, yours included, because you spoke out about it. But as you recall, when they had that hearing, when the report was presented, there were many people who said, we need year-round shelter now. And I think that that has influenced City Council to move more rapidly toward that. And if indeed they have a phase two and a phase three,
that or Andy Mills and, you know, the fact that he has, by a fait accompli, suspended the sleeping ban and camping ban ordinances, at least in part.
Yeah, and I think that was a good starting point. I think it highlighted the inadequacy of a shelter here in the city and the county. When he put people over in the benchlands, that was directly facing the county building, and they realized, wait a minute, you know, we have to respond to this and make some.
Have they responded?
You know, that's a not to any level that I would like. And that's why I'm running for Board of Supervisors. We need to have, as I've said in the campaign for several times, we need to have a shelter system that accommodates at least 300 emergency shelter beds. We need to have an element in the housing programs for the county that creates transitional and permanent supportive housing so that people can get into shelter, can get back into employment, back into benefits.
Some would say these programs are band-aids, that these are also that shelters are horrible places generally.
You can say what you want.
Well, some do. I'm asking you to respond to that in the sense that...
I'm responding to it because I don't think it's that accurate.
So you're dismissing that argument.
Yes, I am dismissing that argument.
And, of course, the real problem is that, this whole talk about housing which doesn't exist is ridiculous. And that's what, Steve Plaich realizes this, I believe, because he's pointed out that with the shift from, for example, where the homeless lack of services center now will only take you in to the Pauley Loft or the Page Smith Community House, if you have a pathway to housing, which means some kind of a check or some kind of a government subsidy. So, in other words, it's no longer an emergency shelter. He's pointed out the need for emergency shelters because there isn't housing, and that's, I think, a relevant point that he has made. But still, to ride that horse real hard in terms of the wonders of the shelter system, shelters are bad places, generally speaking. You get your stuff stolen. They don't treat you like a human being. You can't maintain a normal human life there. It's essentially a pretext for the city to claim it's acting humanely, and also to balm the consciences of guilty liberals and nervous conservatives, and can also keep some homeless people out of sight, and also avoid the kind of legal attacks that, for example, Judge David Carter down in Orange County is pressing against the authorities down there who are running off the Santa Ana Riverway homeless. And he's actually taking the kind of vigorous stand that you rarely see in a federal judge. I may be reading from that one of those news stories later.
If I can get 300 shelter beds or more emergency shelter beds, if I can get real commitments to permanent and transitional supportive housing, then we'll be able to do something for people.
Want to name a city where that's actually happened in California?
I'm not worried about any of the cities that
happened. No, but I mean, given the fact that you have a mob of people here who are
pro-landlord, and who knows? Who knows what their opinions are regarding shelters?
I'm not speculating about who's pro.
Yeah. Well, there's a landlord for rent control. Now that's interesting. He has got a sign,
open public forum.
It is. However, there are. I would wager the majority of this crowd is. Well, we'll see.
There was just an interesting email I came across today. There's an organization forming statewide. They're landlords for rent control.
Oh, yeah? I know. What kind of rent? Is this one of these sort of, false flag deals?
No, I just read the email, and they were saying that we believe that there are landlords who are in favor of rent control, rent stabilization, and we want to organize around that. We're requesting, I think you like, is a Facebook page, maybe, or...
They're supporting abolition of Costa Hawkins? That's what I'm asking, because
that's the larger, theme,
yeah,
of course.
Sure. Anybody can say they're for rent control, but what's in the devil is in the details.
And if the people are successful with their petition drive at getting the repeal of Costa Hawkins on the ballot, then maybe we'll have something to talk about come November.
They've already got a quarter of the signatures.
Well, a quarter is not 100%.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah. Costa Hawkins is a law that essentially prohibits rent control over units that were built after 1995, I believe, with some exceptions, and which allows for immediate vacancy decontrol once a person moves out of a rent-controlled unit, I believe. So it's a way of really giving the entire store over to real estate profiteers. And also individuals, who are not profiteers per se, but trying to get an investment by owning a piece of property and renting it out as a means of making profit off the needs of other people.
We found in the DeSalle signature gathering campaign that there's a point where you get to be about 30 or 40 days out where you either have to commit yourself completely to hiring paid signature gatherers to get yourself over the hump, or find some way to generate more spark in your volunteers, because
Yes, perhaps.
It's a lot of signatures. I mean, we had to get 5,700 verified signatures. We ended up getting 8,800 raw signatures to do that. Hey, how you doing? It's Abby Samuels here.
I've heard of her.
Yes, yeah. And she's piping on a rent control herself.
She has a clipboard with her, and I bet she's signing up people. How many people have you signed up, Abby, in the last?
I've just done three.
Good for you.
Three
sheets is pretty good.
No, no.
Three sheets more than me, man.
Ten people on each sheet.
That's good.
Yeah. I have a question.
Yeah.
If the city isn't enforcing this ordinance, how do they normally enforce ordinances? The police give them a ticket? I mean, how do... That's how it is.
They claim there's no mechanism to enforce these, according to Sandy Brown earlier today. She was telling me that that's one of the problems. The staff is insisting they need to hire more people. It's going to be very expensive. Let the renters themselves take the landlords to court if they want. In other words, fuck off. Leave us alone.
In other words, we just pass this, but it means
paper
nothing.
Bullshit is what it was. Is what the fear is, anyway. What do you say, Steve, as a landlord, rent control advocate?
The problem they had when they passed the original rental ordinance when they were establishing fees for compliance, this was 2-3 years ago. But there just weren't enough inspectors to go around and make sure that people were in compliance with whatever rental ordinance they passed. So it makes it very difficult to enforce if they don't have the staff to canvass all the available rentals and track whether or not those rentals have been increased more than the 2.2% that's allowable between now and November. They don't have a statistical basis.
It's interesting. That was one of the arguments. I think that was one of the arguments made by former council member and sleeping band booster Mike Rotkin when he was mayor, or when he was on the council. One of the many times he was on the council in passing the rental inspection ordinance was that this is all to help the tenants and make sure that they have decent housing, because there isn't enough people to go around to create. To make sure all those violations are dealt with, but a decade later, it's not clear that there have been a significant reduction in and disposition of the complaints that tenants have put in regarding problems with housing that supposedly this rental inspection ordinance was going to address a decade ago. What it really did was it created a bigger bureaucracy that enabled the city upon its whim or the whim of neighbors to enforce more closely code violations and impose fines and so forth. That's my cynical perspective on it. I was able to finally get a list of all the unaddressed complaints and pass it on to a tenant activist, but I'm not sure they've done anything with it. It's time-consuming and tiresome going through such things, and people need help to do that. Hopefully other folks will volunteer, because we really need the factual backing to see if tenant complaints are being addressed. Is it a matter of needing to throw more money at government agencies, or is it a matter of something more fundamental, that these government agencies will continue to serve wealth and power whose interests don't involve the protection of tenants?
They enforce Airbnb rentals. People put their Airbnb on the market.
Poorly. That's one of the reasons why.
So if I wanted to have an Airbnb, I could probably get away with it and it won't be enforced.
This could be an opportunity for you.
I have an extra room.
All right. You got that, folks?
Don't put that on.
That's not going to be on the air, actually. It will probably, but nobody should pay attention to it. You know, it's true.
Those folks, by and large, self-report. Because, you know, they...
We trust them. They're very trustworthy.
Self-report.
Yeah.
But if the neighbor doesn't like me, then they can report me. And then what do they do to enforce it?
Well, then they'd have somebody from the...
So we need the
finance department come out. And they say, how come you're not paying your Airbnb?
We need a goon squad going around from house to house, obviously, knocking on the door.
Send out a finance person.
Yeah, somebody.
So can they send out a finance person to the landlords to say, hey?
That would be more in the purview of the planning department.
And actually, I'm going to comment on this because Mike Rutkin, when he was head of the council, helped pass an ordinance that provided a lot more funding for rental inspection required fees and inspections, and the pretext was that there was a need for more rental inspection. But 10 years later, they haven't done the rental inspections, and it looks like people are going into city council. You are a landlord for rent control. Now, why is that? Are you just cutting off your nose to spite your face here? You don't like your property. What is it?
Let's see. I had a friend who their rent was actually doubled during the middle of the school year, and they had to pay it because they didn't have time to move, and it caused them enormous distress. And I just didn't feel that was fair.
And was this the point at which you changed your mind, or have you had this point of view for a while?
I would say that's the point at which I started being activist. I've always seen and still do see both pros and cons to rent control.
What about Santa Cruz specifically?
Let's see. Santa Cruz specifically. I don't have a lot of stories about Santa Cruz and rent control. That's the only one that really pops to mind.
Now, are you in favor of the abolition of Costa Hawkins?
Gosh, I've heard of that one, but I don't remember what it is.
That allows vacancy decontrol and also bans rent control and on it. I guess it's stuff that was built after 1995.
Ah, okay. Let's see. Yeah, I don't really have a strong opinion on that. My inclination is that provided that we have enforced the you can't be evicted without cause, then vacancy decontrol is okay. But yeah.
Okay. And you want to say what we've been talking about?
What's that?
This is for free radio. Do you want to identify yourself for all your friends? You don't have to.
Sure. Here, I'm Bill Frazier.
Thank you, Bill.
All right.
We're filling up here. It's still a couple of seats left in the first few rows, largely empty, and the council hasn't come back yet. It's 10 to 7.
Oh, you're a main activist here. What do you expect to come from this meeting here at the City Council?
Not much.
Are you, I interrupted your conversation. Do you want to finish it before I interrupt further? Okay.
I'll just keep it short. I don't really expect a whole lot. We don't have much we're asking for. We just want the City Council to notice landlords in the community about the specifics of the law, because the law isn't, because people are still receiving illegal rent increases. So that's all we're really asking for today.
Is there an enforcement mechanism set up yet to enforce this law?
Tenants are expected to take their landlords to court.
And you're already with your battery of attorneys.
Right.
And that is one of the problems, right?
Yeah, we can't pay for attorneys.
And so what do you anticipate will be the step that tenants can take other than complaining on the phone?
People can complain to us, and we send a form letter to the landlord and say, listen, this is what the law is right now, and you're violating it. And that sometimes becomes, that's sometimes enough to convince the landlord, oh, I'm violating the law. You know, but we're not an arm of the city. We shouldn't be enforcing the city's laws.
Is there any indication that this is going to change? There actually will be an enforcement mechanism set up. I had heard discouraging news from a council member earlier today.
I don't know.
Okay. Who should people call if they do have this problem, if they want to get a complaint to send to the landlord or a forum?
They can contact Movement for Housing Justice. MovementForHousingJustice.org or MovementForHousingJustice@gmail.com, or they can call Students United with Renters at 831-471-7842.
How's the petition drive coming?
It's moving along. Been asked not to share numbers right now, but if anybody would like to help, we're always accepting more people to help out with signature gathering. You can contact the same contact information if you want to help out.
Sounds good. Any other thoughts?
No, not really. Not right now.
And we've been talking with
Zav.
Thank you, Zav. And I don't want to go to Pussy Riot as a personal entry on March 27th. I don't want to go to the...
We'll leave aside these personal notes. Pussy Riot was playing at the Catalyst. And but that's another story. I mean, they're a controversial group in Russia, of course, but I don't think they're terribly controversial here in Santa Cruz. And frankly, what I like to talk about on this show is stuff that is isn't being done, that should be done, or that is being done and shouldn't be done. That sort of thing. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. And I'm Robert Norse. If you want to reach me, you can give a call to 423-4833, though this is not a live broadcast. It is being recorded on the same day that it's being played, which is April 5th, 2018.
If there's anyone there has a moment to spare and can give undivided attention, I'd be grateful if you'd give a minute or two and consider some points I would mention. There are slanderous tongues that are ready to wrong and murder the fine reputation of the lads with big feet who, by pounding the beat, are protecting the peace of the nation. There are short-sighted folks who insist that these blokes are just uniformed masters of thuggery. There can be no dispute, if they didn't put the boot in, the country would soon go to buggery. So try and keep calm when they're twisting your arm or planting a fist in your gum. When they're giving you hell in a cold prison cell, they're only just doing their job. When Hitler and co. were running the show, assisted by Germany's coppers, if a nose was too big or a mind was too active, its owner was sure of the chopper. Socialists, communists, Jews and trade unionists landed up dead or in quad. And the police were in there, of course, doing their share. Ah, but they were just doing their job. Il Duce the bully and Franco his cully both loaded their country with chains. And stand in the front ranks of these two mountebanks, were the police of both Italy and Spain. In South Africa, El Salvador, Guatemala, where they call working people the mob. The screams and the yells from the punishment cells show the police are just doing their job. If you're black but just brown, if you're jobless and down, if you speak for a world which is saner, if you stand up and fight for what's yours by right, an anti-nuclear campaigner, remember the chap in the comical hat is one of humanity's crosses. Wherever there's trouble, whatever the struggle, he'll be on the side of the bosses.
And that was They're Only Just Doing Their Job. Again, Ewan McCall and Peggy Seeger.
So I actually have been able to get a hold of Brent Adams, who's an activist with a number of causes, but specifically around homeless issues, both civil rights and social services. Brent, I've recently been looking over your Homeless Outside in Santa Cruz, where you've been attempting to, as you put it, document, I would say it rather serves to expose the inadequacy of the social service phone lines that are available and that are prominently posted in different places, although I don't think I've only seen them once or twice. People can go to Homeless Outside in Santa Cruz to take a look at your videos and hear, you know, your analysis and your attempt to get through on the lines. But why don't you describe briefly what you tried to do and what you found?
Yeah, so I was not hoping to find fault. It was just a critical analysis, just to, what is the experience like when a person calls 211? The experience of the video was it took me 4 minutes to get to talk to somebody at all, and then there was a bit of a question. They wanted to conduct a survey, and there was a few different weird advertisement things. When I was finally talking to somebody who was clearly in a call center, not within the county, and didn't know about anything, you know, relating to homelessness in Santa Cruz, didn't have any knowledge whatsoever about anything called a winter shelter, and the only thing that they came up with for shelter tonight was the warming center, which was not open, and had some, information from last year for a single night of opening, which was very frustrating to me because that could really steer somebody wrong. If somebody needs shelter, they'll head out to the wrong place. That's the worst scenario of all. But they did have, upon asking the question, finally, is there a phone number? They gave me, you know, my own phone number, which, I mean, the hotline phone number for Warming Center program. Well, you go down the city's website, and additionally that flyer that the city had been posting, it's called Homeless Services Notification, that they posted in late February, early March, and were giving to all camps when they were cleaning them up or prior to. There's no information whatsoever about the winter shelter, how to contact it. Homeless Services Center doesn't answer their phone, and there's not only zero information, it appears to be an incorrect phone number or a weird number. Then you get to the River Street. Luckily, you actually talk to somebody. They staff somebody at the River Street shelter. That's, funded by Encompass by way of, you know, state, city HUD funding. But they did give us the hotline for homeless services, for the winter shelter, which was striking because the winter shelter has not even ever given me that number, and that was kind of weird. But when you do call the hotline for the winter shelter, you do just get another recording. So the only person you're able to talk to at all with any straight information about, what's up is the Warming Center hotline, 234-9848. So I went through four videos just to kind of go through that process because I've mentioned it to Chris Crow, I mentioned it at City Council a few times, and their eyes just kind of glaze over. There's not seeming interest at all and what the experience is for somebody who's outside. A lot of effort is put into some of these programs, a lot of money, but why isn't there a point of contact for somebody on the street?
I mean, and even
glaring question. If they're serving people on the street, how do they expect people to get there? Short of.
I mean, and also, as I recall, you were calling at 7 o'clock in the evening, according to the video.
Yeah.
The key question is, have you got shelter for me tonight? And, of course, the winter shelter program will be ending completely on April 14th. There'll be a 20-person shelter for the Association of Faith Communities for people who are pretty much already in it and disabled. And there'll be this campground, which has a long waiting list, and I'm not sure what they're doing there. Maybe you can give me an update on that shortly. And then, of course, there's what else is there? It looks like there's, you know, it's instructive to hear the kind of hoops that homeless people are put through, but the ultimate product at the end doesn't seem to be there.
Yeah. I think it's, so I hope people on city council, really, you know, within the city government, become aware that that's what they're putting people up to. I just met with a guy named Evan Morrison, who is the veterans director at Homeless Services Center yesterday, and he's putting together, you know, a lot of people put together these lists of services thinking that, you know, rightly so, that that's a real, you know, an important tool and it's going to really help people. But no one's actually going service by service, you know, finding out, you know, what is this service like? How do you, what is it like when you try to access this service? Additionally, we're not putting all the quote-unquote services up on the big board to look at what's actually missing. What do people need? What are the basic needs? How easy is it for them to access basic needs? We will list off the many, you know, potable drinking water. Where do people get underwear when they need it? You know, laundry, basic hygiene. And then I'm talking about Monday through, you know, 7 days a week, are people able to access food readily and easily without traveling a great distance? And that also becomes a concern.
You know, I know that Merity, who is an activist who worked with Food Not Bombs and with the Freedom Sleepers, and he worked with you too, for all I know, she put out a list, and I think Jennifer, who now works or was working out at the River Street campground, tried to go through all those numbers. It may have been someone else who did this, and found it was just the list that Merity gave out actually led to real places and real services. And yeah, I think your service was one of them. Food Not Bombs was another. But there were relatively very few services that actually people could directly connect with. But I found of interest, you had a, well, let me ask you first about the River Street campground. Do you have any updates on that? I have not yet gotten my treasured visitor's pass to go in there. So.
Yeah, we had, of course, you know, a month ago, or more than a month ago, within 4 days of the encampment opening, I was not able to, you know, enter the camp. I was worse than that. I was driven away and persona non grata. It was very depressing for me to experience that because I've been following some stories and I've been, you know, documenting camps all over the Northwest. But that, besides that, I wanted to give donations because we, Warming Center, has a huge stock of sheets and pillows. And but then all I did was simply, you know, realizing that I couldn't. I'll just follow the basic protocol. The basic protocol is deliver them on Friday between 8 a.m. and 11 a.m. at the City Hall, which I did, and interacted with Susie O'Hara and Chris Monteith there. And it actually was pretty straightforward. So that's my only update. I interact with people in the camp on a regular basis, positive, negative responses. But all in all, you know, mainly what I want to talk about that is that it's, you know, $100,000 a month plus for the encampment. The city says it's already out of budget. They're taking that money from the non-existent Scott Collins city manager assistant salary. They're moving, and then the news recently said that half of the camp, more than half of the camp of 62 campers, are actually members of the downtown streets team. That's the program that the city's already funded at $400,000. And now we're waiting to hear new numbers because they're out at the beachfront and in Harvey West. So we expect that, you know, the price tag has just been bumped up. Additionally, So downtown streets team is being funded, and they're given priority within the encampment. Not only that, half of those are given jobs at $17 an hour within the encampment. So I'm not against the streets team. I think there's valuable things to be said about it. But additionally, that's the city doubling, tripling down on a handful of people, by the tune of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, while everyone else is left completely high and dry.
Brent, what does the streets team actually do outside the campground? Do you know?
Yeah, they outside the campground. So inside the campground, they're paid hosts, and they're hired 24 hours a day.
But outside
the campground, they're out there. It's well known. They pick up garbage. They go out as a team. They have buckets and garbage picker uppers. They pick up cigarette butts. Now they're starting to clean up messy areas within the neighborhoods. Hold on a sec. I might actually have to go here.
Well, we don't have a lot of time anyway. I guess one last question. What are the experiences of people inside the campground? What have you found? What have they told you, if anything?
I'm sorry. It looks like my vehicle is being ticketed. Let me put this on hold just for a second.
Sure. You go ahead.
I have a problem right now.
Do it. Thank you, Brent.
Go.
And good luck to Brent on that vehicle ticket. Hope he is able to avoid it. Here's a story from a month ago from Manteca, which is a Central Valley, Southern California town about the size of Santa Cruz, a little bigger maybe. And it's reads as follows. Manteca anti-camping law, is it on trial? Norman J. Moore is not going away. He's a 71-year-old homeless man who has been homeless for the good part of a year after the home where he was staying with a friend was sold. He gets $800 a month in Social Security. There was a time in his life when he made bad decisions. He lost a business during a recession in the Midwest, ended up in the Bay Area near family, and did handyman type of work until drinking cost him his driver's license. Long story short, he's homeless. Moore has asked for help. He's been told the best option is a subsidized senior living complex. There's just one problem. It's a long waiting list, 2 years, 5 years, who knows. Why the city of Manteca needs to worry about Moore has everything to do with what happened last year. He was cited for illegal camping under the Manteca Municipal Code Section 12.20.030. The ticket is for $1,205. Oh, that's more expensive than Santa Cruz. Do the math. Moore receives $800 a month and likely has to eat. The city's attorney did offer a compromise punishment that included community service work. Moore may be homeless, but he's not a stupid man. If he has no shelter, that means he's camping somewhere in and around Manteca every night. He could receive 100 tickets and be slapped with $120,000 in fines and isn't going to solve anything. So Moore said no to the deal and exercised his right to a jury trial. You don't get a jury trial for camping tickets in Santa Cruz. You just get $200 fines that go south and then become $500 fines. Though, as recently, there have been very few camping tickets. They instead use being in a park after dark tickets, things of that sort. Or get along, keep moving, we'll take your stuff. That was something I intended to ask Brent about because he has a video on his Homeless Outside in Santa Cruz Facebook page, which shows city employees removing a man's property, throwing it into a garbage bag, some of it they're setting aside, while the man sits in a squad car. I encourage people to take a look at that. So anyway, Norman J. Moore is in Judge Northrup's courtroom in Stockton on Friday, March 16th. Jury selection, this is already over, but it started on Monday, March 19th, and the trial was underway in earnest on Tuesday, March 20th. Moore believes the entire homeless issues will be on trial and the city of Manteca ordinance. Whether that is true or not depends on how pumped up, skillful, and persuasive his court-appointed attorney is. On the surface, if I was on the jury, this issue would have no problem prevailing, as based on the law was written, he clearly violated it. But what happens if a jury is persuaded the ordinance as written makes being homeless illegal? The one out the city has is the wording of the ordinance that allows anybody, homeless or not, to sit or lie on public property between the hours of 11 p.m. and 6 a.m. The ordinance carves out exceptions for the Manteca Transit Center and Moffett Community Center, the Manteca Veterans Center, but not places like the grounds of the Manteca Civic Center where it is legal to sit or lie, in other words, camp, between the hours of 11 p.m. and 6 a.m. The Civic Center vacant lots owned by the city, the area outside the animal shelter, and other municipal buildings, including the front landscaping of fire stations, are the only legal places besides sidewalks as long as there is adequate passage for the handicapped as dictated by federal law. That's because parks are legally closed to everyone overnight, and other laws make it illegal to sit or lie in streets or the right-of-way of a freeway. Not sure what that means, but moving on. The ordinance clearly prohibits camping on private property unless it is by family or friends of the property owner with their permission and is not for more than one consecutive night. It is why the city is going after a downtown property owner that has given homeless permission to do just that between the walls of the roofless building and the 300 block of West Yosemite Avenue. The city is enforcing the rules to a degree, but neither government or the courts move at the speed of life. This brings us to Moore's second dilemma. He is asking people to break the law to help him. He has issued a plea to anyone with a piece of property to give him permission to set up his tent until such time as he can get housing. He asks that they call and gives them contact numbers and places of people to call. Of course, if the property is within the city limits, they'd be breaking the law by allowing Moore to set up his tent. The ordinance makes it clear where camping or the use of camp paraphernalia is allowed and where it is not. It does beg the question whether the more respectable homeless do with their stuff between the hours of 6 a.m. and 11 p.m. This, of course, is the problem for Salinas homeless. If they sleep on, or for Santa Cruz homeless for that matter, you have to carry your stuff around with you. Try to sit down. You will find yourself moved along. Or let's put it this way. You have no defense against the move-along demand. And you try to imagine how humiliating that ultimately becomes and how wearisome that becomes. If they sleep on public sidewalks and commercial areas or at the Manteca Civic Center, they can't leave their stuff in those places between 6 a.m. and 11 p.m. Moore in the past has rented self-storage space to stash his stuff. Most homeless that haven't secured an undetected illegal camping site either stash their stuff in landscaping around town or else lug it with them. An obvious partial remedy is to do what some cities have done in Southern California, where piles of camping paraphernalia stashed in landscaping or sitting on commercial sidewalks was detrimental to business as well as public health and safety. And, of course, it was just aesthetically completely unacceptable. They took an older, unused building, such as the City of Manteca's former vehicle maintenance building on Wetmore Street, and employed garbage carts to allow the homeless to store belongings. I hadn't heard much about that. That they can access for an hour in the morning and an hour in the late afternoon to reduce junk piles in the street as well as provide a secure place homeless can place their belongings. Homeless possessions, of course, are simply junk, as we know, where they aren't using them. Just remember, Moore and other homeless aren't going away. And, of course, Santa Cruz denied homeless people that option throughout the winter. And when none other than Brent Adams, the man we just heard on the air here, had planned to open up and did open up or arranged to open up a site for storage of homeless property actually at the Boneyard Barbed Wire River Street campground site. But he was unceremoniously turned away from that, even though he'd arranged, got an employee, had a contract ready, was ready to go, something I've talked about before on this show. No storage for the homeless. I guess their storage is at the city dump, which, of course, is illegal because you're not supposed to be dumping people's property. You're supposed to store it, and you have to have good reason to confiscate it. The city creates, of course, its own good reasons, the city government. And there may be good news down in Orange County where Judge David Carter, who has been defending the rights of homeless people being driven away from the Santa Ana Riverway and then supposedly offered shelter by the Orange County Board of Supervisors, but then that was turned back by massive bust-in protest by angry NIMBYs who didn't want a homeless shelter in one of their three towns. I guess the three towns involved were what? Santa Ana. Still looking for them. In the Orange County area. There was a hearing on April 3rd, and here's a story about it. What happens when a judge calls on Orange County cities to talk about housing homeless people? And there's a picture of Sean Happen holding a sign showing support for U.S. District Judge David Carter outside the federal courthouse in Santa Ana on Tuesday last week. Carter held a court session wherein he invited all of Orange County's mayors and city managers to talk about housing homeless people. The short version of this story, and I kind of apologize for reading the long Manteca story. I tried to follow the update on whatever happened to this guy's fighting the camping ban there in Manteca, and there was nothing I could find online about it. But what the Orange County judge has said is, I can't make you give homeless people shelter, but I can sure make sure you don't arrest them under the sleeping ban, or that if you do, you'll be held accountable in court under camping ordinances. And that's the threat that David O. Carter has used to draw together mayors and city managers from various cities in Orange County, and they all, of course, are proposing all kinds of plans, which I'm not too optimistic about. There's a lot of blather, a lot of talk. And the real concern, I guess, is that people who have been driven out of the Santa Ana Riverway and then out of the motels that the judge insisted they be given at least 30 days in, supposedly as a pathway to housing, but actually not as a pathway to any housing that I've heard about, that then they showed up at the Santa Ana Civic Center, where there's been a tent city for a long time, apparently. And that is essentially consolidating and concentrating homeless people in one area that, you know, it burdens, it's the kind of the concern that Santa Cruz NIMBYs have. It's not an entirely unjustified when they're saying, why is everybody coming to Santa Cruz? It must be because they're so wonderful to the homeless. Actually, it's because it's the seat of the services. That's where people get their various services in the county, and the same is true, apparently, down in Santa Ana. In any case, he's threatening the mayors if they don't come up with shelter alternatives, and they have been receiving money from the feds and just not using it, and from state authorities, which again is a favorite trick of these greedy, selfish, narrow-minded politicians in power. And that's, I'm afraid, really the only way to describe how they treat homeless people. Mike Rhodes did an excellent, he did a documented study of that, wrote a book about it, how it happened in Fresno. But I hope Carter is successful in pressuring these political clowns. That would be nice to hear. I think he was being supported. He got into that situation because the ACLU and other groups actually took action down there, unlike in Santa Cruz, where they aren't doing squat around these issues. And don't believe it, by the way, when the local ACLU tells you, oh, we can't do anything because we need the Northern California to do something. We don't have any legal power to do it without their okay. My response to them is, then form an autonomous chapter. My response to them is, then hire your own attorneys down here. My response is, then hold press conferences and educational sessions. And there has been a little of that, but so little that it really seems to be relatively meaningless so far here in Santa Cruz. So I was unable to get Joyful Heart, who's also known as Swami, by the way, or Bhakta. You may know him as that. He's a fellow who dresses all in black, wears a hat, used to play the guitar in front of the coffee roasting company or nearby, and also did some music out on the wharf, played a lot of Beatles tunes, and could occasionally be found at the Red Church on Mondays at the Calvary Episcopal food shindig playing music. He works now out at the homeless lack of services center, but that's not true. It's the River Street Campground. They actually have their food prepared in the Homeless Lack of Services Center kitchen, which is fine. But he is one of the downtown safety team that you heard Brent critique previously, that gets $17 an hour and then gets money for being in the campground, takes up half of the, or a large minority of the River Street camp spaces. It's sort of a special, almost like it's a camp for them, if Brent's evaluation is correct. Anyway, he reported to me. I was hoping to have him actually for a live interview, but haven't got him. But I hope to get him in days ahead. There's been a lot of turnover, he pointed out, in the last week. Actually, I think he was talking about the week before this week. 10 or 20 people left the camp, some because of dissatisfaction with other residents, some because of personal friction. They usually come back in a few days, he said. Some left because they got housing. Some say, this isn't for me. Some left because of problems. There are, if there's a problem and some people have to be told to leave the River Street Campground, I understand from what he tells me, they get a 24-hour stay away, and then they can come back. And then if that doesn't work, they get a week stay away. It sounds like the David Chirazis Parks and Rec approach. Chirazis, as I've mentioned in the past, was on the library board and decided the way to discipline people who are falling asleep in the library was to evict them first for a day, then for a week, and, you know, teach them just not to fall asleep during the day. I mean, after all, it's not a good thing, not in the library, if you violate a rule or you offend a library personnel person. And so that whole method was extended to Parks and Rec, so that if you get an infraction ticket, then you have to stay away for, first it was a day, then they changed the law to make it 3 days, and if it happens a second time, it's 3 weeks, then 3 months. And if you violate that during that time, you get up to a year in jail and a $1,000 fine. So apparently they're using a similar system, though, presumably without the jail and the time, just the week we're kicking you out for 24 hours and then for a week if you violate the rules. It's not been another community meeting. They've apparently had one community meeting there. And he did say that there was a shuttle schedule. There were shuttles were running at 7, 8, 10, noon, 2, 3, 6, 10, and 8, 10. What he did not know, or at least did not have with him at the time, was the shuttle schedule. He knows that the shuttle does go to Coral Street, River Street parking garage behind Wells Fargo, Laurel in front, and Emmeline Street. And so that's more information about where you can... It isn't clear when the shuttle arrives, but if it leaves the River Street campground out on Highway 9 at 7, 8, 10, noon, 2, 3, 6, 10, and 8, 10, then you can imagine maybe arrives within the next hour after there. And he also seemed to indicate that shuttle service was, to some extent, made available. I don't know if I understood this properly from him. If you needed to go between 3 and 6 in the afternoon, you might be able to persuade. It's not clear. I don't want to put words into a Joyful Heart's mouth. That's, again, what he calls himself. There also is a monthly meeting, a weekly meeting every Thursday of the downtown safety team that he is a part of and that serves as the internal police force in the camp, or the internal hospitality squad, however you want to put it. They meet every Thursday, and I didn't get to it today, at 12:30 at the 418 building on Front Street. And it's open to the public in case people are interested. They can check that out. And I was going to play and will be playing an interview with tenant activist Cynthia Berger going into more detail on the rent control ordinance as it currently exists and the rent control ordinance as is being proposed for final passage as an initiative, as well as more information around that issue and the just eviction protection part of that as well. But that should be on Sunday when this show resumes at 9:30, or I get another edition of it then. And in the meantime, you're going to have to content yourself with a little bit of music to, come down off this show on. And if you want to get in touch with me, you can reach me at the Huff number, 423-HUFF, 423-4833. and I will try to answer any questions. And if you want to volunteer to help with any researching any of these issues, or you have news reports on what's going on outside, stuff you think that the community should know about, call me and let me know. 423-4833, area code 831. And let's also note that here's another little bit of, I'd say perhaps a bit of gloom. Let's play what this is by Gerard Ahrens. A lawyer says the city of San Diego treats dockless bikes better than its homeless, from KGTV. Let's see if I can get this to play.
The city is facing a class action lawsuit from a lawyer who says they treat dockless bikes better than homeless people.
10 News reporter Jared Aaron spoke with the lawyer behind this suit, who says it all boils down to one poorly written law.
As San Diego's homeless population surges, people living on the street face a daily hassle, the city's encroachment statute.
Municipal Code 54.010.
A law which says it's a misdemeanor to erect, place, allow to remain, construct, establish, plant, or maintain any vegetation or object on any public street, alley, sidewalk, highway, or other public property or public right-of-way. Lawyer Scott Dreher says San Diego has used that law against the city's homeless. He says encroachment citations went up 83% during the hepatitis A outbreak last fall. Now he's filed a class action lawsuit.
You see a statute that's so vague that it can be subjectively enforced. That's just wrong. That goes against everything we were taught.
Dreher says the best example he can find of the inconsistencies in the law rolled into town just a few months ago. Dockless bikes and scooters, which are all over city sidewalks.
Technically, that's illegal. That bike, if this were a homeless person's stuff, the cops would come and take it, give him a ticket, a misdemeanor, maybe arrest him if he had more than one.
But the city leaves the bikes alone. We contacted all of the dockless bike companies in San Diego. They say they tell users about local laws in their apps. Tyrone Harris, who lives on the street, calls it ironic.
They put more value on that bike than they do on my personal property. They won't come and throw this company's bikes away. They'll come and take everything I own and dump it.
And that was Jared Aaron's reporting. And the city attorney's office has yet to file a response to the lawsuit. They turned down our request for an interview. Dreher says that he's met with the city and thinks a solution could be built for more storage units for the homeless.
And the attorney you heard quoted or speaking was Scott Dreher, responsible for the Spencer decision in San Diego a decade ago that came after the Jones decision in Los Angeles, which overturned the sleeping ban, sitting, lying bans in both those two cities, and established more wiggle room for homeless people. I wouldn't say an end to the criminalization of homeless people. That ain't happening. It ain't happened yet. It'll happen God knows when. And if you don't believe in God, that's not a very positive prospect. That's about it for this edition of Bathroom Spears Broadsides. Before I finally say goodbye, let me take one more look around. I think I'm going to call it and go out on a song by Ryan Harvey, In the Name of Western Democracy. And again, talk at you again on Sunday, if I'm in the mood.
Direction and purpose in the lion pride. Will you be the one? Oh, for the mountains and valleys are the city streets. Will you be the one? Oh, to keep moving forward and never retreat. Out there. establishing a nation where they all will be free. So the lionesses rise to the occasion and nurture them with conscious meditation. In this jungle out there, life is unfair for the ones left to scrape for the scraps. Generations have grown in the same situation. Tribal warfare, chance to slavery, and now taxes. The people never have enough. Children are both fatherless, and families have no one to rely on. So from blood, sweat, and tears, the solution appears. The pride is defended by a lion.
So them can't find the light in the dark. Caught up and lost in themselves. So them can't find the right path to walk. Vanity guides them. So when them speak, we don't see no truth in not them mind. Them never build, them only break up and resign. I just some sweet reggae music when I play it. I just some positive words I come for saying. Straight forward, me tried, me not go swaying. Mental liberation, I am relaying. I said we got to stand up, my people. Shift gear and forward like vehicle. I guess we got to stand up, my people. Like over that time, it's a good over. One king alone is the ruler. I am blessed, the almighty watch over. The foundation, he is the anchor. Yeah. One king alone is the ruler. I am blessed, the almighty watch over. The foundation, yes, he is the anchor. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. The anchor, yeah. Let me know. Solid as a rock to the ages,
to the ages.
The beginning and near the end. Oh, your love is never changing.
Never does.
Never rearranging.
So I'm telling you,
yeah.
If they didn't know, Ziggy, let me tell them now. Hey, Lord, remember I like King David. And blessed every man that share loving. The dawning of the day and the evening. Be oh such a man worthy of praises. Can we be little children in righteousness? Never let in our gates any wickedness. Is he that dwelleth in the secret places? Shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. Pick up the right and put on the wrong. And don't you ever look back. Don't you ever forget all vengeance belong to Jah. Sometimes it gotta be the only way for us to learn. Get redemption from him and all those gotta be the sweetest people.
King alone is the ruler.
Yeah,
I am blessed, the Almighty watch over. His foundation, he is the anchor.
Yes, sing it, tell him again.
One king alone is the ruler. I am blessed, the Almighty watch over. The foundation, he is the anchor.
Yes,
he is the anchor.
Kingdom is open for all to come in Yahweh. So never you doubt yourself. We have nothing to fear around here. The anchor is here, year after year. Hold on to faith, oh yeah. I must say one king alone is the ruler. I am blessed, the almighty watch over. The foundation, yes, he is the anchor.
One king alone is the ruler. I am blessed, the almighty watch over. The foundation, yes, he is the anchor.
I'm losing all control. faith. It's alright, champagne and candlelight. The way you hold me tight, girl, I can't fight this feeling. Oh, no.
Woman, you're nice. Smile upon your face is like you rise up on the night. Tell me, can't wait to give you everything you like. Hope you from the day your Christmas sights. I guarantee that you'll be satisfied. Don't be afraid to break the rules. And to bet I've been so tell the little man to cool. I'm the lucky star, I can't believe I found a tool. And them all ask what you want to do. So make the note that up me have the tool.
The way you make me feel, from deep down in my soul, I'm losing all control. Girl, I can't fight this